All right. Well, Catherine, thank you very much. Hi, everyone. I'm Pete Avis. And many of you met me, I think it was in 2018, if I'm not mistaken, October 2018. So a little over a couple of years ago. And I visited you all out in Niles, which is a nice evening, I remember. And I talked about my work with the stinky fetid rushulas that few people pay much attention to. but since then, lots of things have happened. One of the many things that has happened since then is I've moved from Indiana to Maine. and so I'm actually not at Indiana University anymore. Although technically I am for the next couple months, but we'll start officially a position at the University of Maine here in Orono, which is where I'm tuning in to this from. Despite that, I'm gonna tell you a story about some of the work that I did in Indiana at Mount Baldy. And it's a mycological story, but I think it didn't start off that way. And so I guess maybe I'll just dive right into it. Catherine says that we'll take questions at the end of this. So I guess maybe hold them until then, unless it's really burning and needs to be asked. Otherwise, let me share my screen and away we go. Okay. So this is a story about what fungi have to do with things called devil's stovepipes. And this is an image of me at the top or near the top of Mount Baldy, which is the largest sand dune at the Indiana Dunes National Park. This was a bit of work that I did back in 2015. And if you look hard enough, you can see the Chicago skyline way out here, just to give you a kind of point of reference, right? We're on the southern shore of Lake Michigan, and I'm sitting up on a big pile, basically a big pile of sand, which is what Mount Baldy is. But let me start off with a quote from a novel, a fictional novel by Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey's famous for his book, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But he wrote some other books, and this one, called Sometimes a Great Nation. He mentions this thing called the devil's stovepipe, and I'll read this little excerpt from this. He said, a boy falls into a devil's stovepipe, which is explained as, this here was a pine forest long ago. These dunes didn't used to be here, just trees, but the winds kept banking the sand higher and higher and finally covered up the forest, clean to the top of the trees, and the trees eventually rotted out, leaving these hollows where they used to be, maybe just barely covered at the top. So that's, again, sort of a fictional account, but I suspect that Ken Kesey, this was a novel based on the things that were happening on the Oregon coast, which have a lot of sand dunes as well, probably saw some of these things. I grew up hearing stories from my dad, who was a native of Western Michigan, and he'd always tell us these stories about quicksand, and I sort of scratch my heads, and my buddies and I would wonder about this kind of thing. But fast forward to 2013, a little boy and his family had been visiting the Indiana Dunes Park and decided to go kind of a little side hike off of Mount Baldy, and the boy saw a little depression and sort of all of a sudden got swallowed up in this hole. And at the time, no one really understood what was going on at all. The boy was down in the hole deep, right? They estimate somewhere in the order of 15 to 20 feet. The sand had largely collapsed in on him. And fortunately, the little guy recovered after being in this hole. And you can see, I'm not going to play the video here, but this was on all the news channels, right? This is from just a screenshot of CNN. I had to, you know, get in the heavy equipment on Mount Baldy, the backhoes and whatnot, started to dig frantically to get the boy out. This made the news from all over. Here's NPR and a picture at the surface of a little bit of that. Different journals over the next, I'd say, year or so started to pick this up, and sort of the popular press, Smithsonian, and a picture from the slip side of Mount Baldy, and kind of what that looks like. And again, the mystery of why this dangerous sand dune swallowed a boy. And the work here that this particular article describes is not particularly my research, but it was a colleague of mine, Erin Argelon, who's a geoscientist, who I'll reference here in just a little bit. She happened to be on the sand dune at the time the boy was trapped. She studies dune morphology and how these dunes sort of do their thing. And at the time it was really kind of a mystery. How do these holes in a dune form such large enough for a little child to fall in? Here's an image of one of these holes. As you can kind of see, the tape measure here is probably 6 or 7 inches in diameter. Mostly kind of a smooth structure and holding its sort of sides, intact, at least for the time being, long enough to kind of take images. And again, if you were a small creature or a little boy, you could probably fall into that hole. Here's a picture of that boy who made it alive. Again, I think they took about 4 hours to get him, locate him. They rushed him to the hospital and spent a good bit of time cleaning out his lungs, because he did, you know, inhale a lot of the sand and whatnot. But apparently he said he found a little pocket of air somewhere in where he had fallen, and it was enough to keep him breathing through that ordeal. And again, at the time it was mysterious how this had formed. The dune scientists had sort of hadn't really heard of this thing, at least here in Indiana. So out of an abundance of caution, the park closed this particular area. It's since been opened up, but it was closed for a good long while. So kind of backing out, in trying to figure out a bit of this mystery. Again, I learned from the geoscientists who were sort of got involved in this right away that they wanted to get a sense of, you know, was this a sort of just a really haphazard event, or was it a bit more common? So one of the things that they were able to do was to kind of map out the dune with an instrument they call a ground penetrating radar, which is basically a radar that they point in the ground, and it looks sort of for anything that's holding moisture. And where they find the moisture, it sort of sends back a little signal that says, there's something holding moisture in here. And they call those anomalies. So they mapped the entire Mount Baldy with it, and they started to notice these little sort of lines of structures or lines of areas, these little dots here. And one of these little anomalies corresponded to the exact location where that boy Nathan had fallen into the hole. And so this started to kind of really further raise the question of, you know, what was under those dunes? Was it some kind of, you know, maybe old object or maybe wooden structure? And it was about this time that, again, my geomorphology colleague sort of brought this to my attention. As a mycologist, I first thought, well, it's probably some wood, some tree or something like that, a bit like this idea from Ken Kesey. Again, I hadn't read that book at all and then hadn't heard of that term, but you know, it was sort of not out of the realm of possibility, at least in my mind. And I think this would be true for all of you, that one thing that could be going on here is that some sort of wooden structure is being decomposed, and that's what's creating the cavity that could sort of form this space that a child could fall into. let me show you some pictures of Mount Baldy here, just so you can kind of get a sense of what the layout is like. This is a sort of a picture from the northwest looking sort of southeast across the Mount Baldy area. The cooling towers over here are just at the edge of Michigan City. And this whole area here is kind of an active dune. So this whole bit of Mount Baldy is slowly moving inland. I think the estimates are a foot or two a year. The front end of it is been sort of restored and revegetated with marum grass, and they're trying to kind of contain it a little bit, largely because there's a parking lot in the backside that is getting sort of covered by this. This is a look more from the southwest towards the northeast, and you can see some of the industry there in Michigan City, and then you can see the kind of the pier out of Michigan City. One of the reasons that Mount Baldy is doing what kind of growing the way it's growing is partially related to this. This structure out in the water. I've learned from the geomorphology folks is that there's a sort of a belt of sand that kind of circulates Lake Michigan, and when you put a barrier in place, that kind of keeps all the sand from sort of doing its normal sort of movement around, and well, it piles up in sort of the northwest side of things, and then that means there's more sand on this side of that pier, and more of that can get blown out. So that's where you get a really kind of semi-natural dune on this particular location. And that's why Mount Baldy is the size it is and sort of moving the way it's moving. And then this is a little bit up close to that location where that little boy fell in. So after my sort of geomorphology colleague sort of brought this to my attention, she said, well, why don't you go out there and take a look at it? But to go out there, you need to, you know, work with the national park because they need to be with you so that in case someone else, if you fall in, right, they can call for help and whatnot. So this is my first trip up to Mount Baldy. And this was my guide, Josh. He was a Park Service employee there. And actually found one of these holes. I don't have the little video to show here, unfortunately, but I do have some pictures of it. I was sort of leaned over looking at something else. And he said, oh, there's one. And sure enough, he popped his foot into one of these little holes. And so I quickly dropped, sort of kind of pivoted around. We started to look at it, and it was really pretty amazing. Again, sort of living in the dunes for the last 15 or so years, you get used to just sand, piles of sand, and there's, you know, a few bits and pieces of things in there, but you don't think of holes in these. And so, you know, when we saw this, we kind of like, oh wow, this is, let's check this out. So you can see that the hole started while we were up there, and he had just stepped his foot down just a little bit and sort of noticed that it gave away, and then we kind of pried it open a little bit. So this, I would say this is about the size of a baseball cap here. And then we pulled back the sides a little bit, and a couple of things to notice is that the sides are really smooth, really smooth. It's like, you know, not, you know, the sand is generally kind of smooth, but it was just a hollow little cavity. It wasn't full of anything, at least at the time that it opened up to us. I was sort of curious to see if I could sort of feel into it and reach down into the bottom. So I stuck my arm in into the hole, and I could not sort of in the middle part of it. I couldn't touch them. I couldn't feel anything down there, and I felt kind of cool air. It was definitely cool to my hand. You know, it was a summer day and whatnot. And we started to dig out a little bit more, and so you can see into the hole a little bit. You can see sort of where we dug out, And also the other thing to notice here is this is a big sort of chunk of organic matter. And actually the reason that I was sort of pivoted around from this spot was that I was looking at this section of a tree, or basically a tree trunk coming out of the top of that sort of little location. And the other kind of neat thing is all those little anomalies that I showed you before, many of those correspond to these little, what look like highly, highly rotted trees kind of poking off the surface. And so I had sort of looked at that other end of this thing, and that's when Josh found the hole and we kind of came back around, and I followed that tree trunk that I was looking at all the way down to the hole, and it made a perfect connection. It was like if you kept drawing that tree trunk out, that's exactly where it would have been, except it was a hollow hole. It was gone. It was just nothing. And so the sort of connection of these holes to a little decomposing chunk of matter was definitely pretty obvious. And so this particular hole we marked with this pole, and I came back a week later to basically, I'm saying, okay, we've got to, you know, we're going to get some samples of that organic matter. We're going to get some sand samples and see what we can sort of figure out. And when we got back, that hole was completely gone. It was filled. And we tried digging around a little bit, couldn't find it. And so these are kind of ephemeral types of structures that are, you know, as the sand is sort of moving across, at a certain point, there's enough of a cavity that be near the surface of that dune to open up. So, you know, the question of, you know, what's really going on here? And, you know, the science comes to the rescue, or at least to provide some kind of you know, reasonable explanation of what's actually happening here. And along with Aaron Argelon and some other folks, we put together sort of an initial sort of model of what happened. Again, this is largely based off of understanding of the geomorphology of dunes, what can happen to structures like trees, and certainly as they decompose, and then put that together sort of to develop this model. Okay. And the model was really sort of taking advantage of, in addition to the georeference, or excuse me, the ground penetrating radar, the utility of aerial imagery from long ago. So here are some aerial photographs of the area which Mount Baldy exists from 1939. And the imagery at that time, this is pre-World War II, but in the heyday of you know, steel mills, of course. So there's actually some pretty good imagery there. And this image, you can see the Lake Michigan is just up here where the letter B is. This is where the dune is. And each of these little dots right here correspond to those measured anomalies that you saw in a previous picture, except in the previous picture, right, that was buried in sand. So in fact, if we overlay those now, we go the other direction. So we fast forward about 80 years or 75 years or so, these green dots here are the same green dots here. And what you see moved inland is Mount Baldy. So you've basically seen the sand sort of slowly grow, sort of push in over the top of these structures here. And so the dots right here have not moved, right? They're specific georeference locations, so they can basically map those on a previous, you know, image. And so they really know well how much that dune has moved across the landscape. Okay, so the first thing to kind of note here is that this dune has moved a lot, and it covered up basically a previous set of vegetation. In particular, the dune geomorphology folks get really into their, you know, their landscape types of measurements and whatnot. So this is basically, again, the study site here, Michigan City. Zoom into to Mount Baldy here in this big panel here. And they can build these maps here. Basically, this is Mount Baldy here. And then this little line right here is effectively the kind of continuation of an older dune. And what, so this is Mount Baldy currently. What Mount Baldy has moved onto is an older dune that was vegetated with trees. And this little spot right here is now that kind of spot where that dune is now just getting off of that older dune. And I think it makes a little bit more sense in this. And this was kind of the model that we put together. So the top panel here, think of these larger lines here at the top. Here's Mount Baldy moving across an older dune that's fixed in place, right? Because the old dunes don't move and they had vegetation on them. So like this little oak tree here, for instance, and it's kind of on the backside of it. That's the sort of location of a lot of these trees. And then the dunes moving, you know, time one, time two, time three, and that's, you know, kind of the general direction of it. But then also what you have going on inside the tree, or at least we propose this as one of the potential ways this could happen, is kind of a process of decomposition. At time one, you know, as that tree is basically buried here, is there, you know, the conditions, if the conditions are right, this sort of cavity inside that tree could continue to open up and get larger, such that by the time you get to time three, what you've got is this location now, you're right here, and there's this decay cavity inside what used to be the tree, and now the dune is just now coming up to the top of that hole. Okay, so does this actually happen? I mean, can we see trees that decompose like this? And this, here's an image of one of those trees at the top of the dune. Well, you all know pretty well, yeah, heart rot happens all the time. In fact, if you look in your backyard or your neighbor's yard, right, probably won't take too long. And this is especially the case in Northwest Indiana. You'll see a lot of these trees that are hollowed out right in the middle. And, you know, it's fungus busy decomposing the inside of those trees. Here's actually one later this same summer that little boy fell in that hole on Mount Baldy. Here's a tree that was my neighbor's tree that fell onto my house in the Miller section of Gary that I lived in. And sure enough, inside this tree, it was all rotted out right in the middle. Okay. And so the next question is, okay, so trees clearly do this in Northwest Indiana, near the dunes, in the dunes, really. What else do you need for decomposition? And that's where the mycology starts, right? We need fungus for this. We need some kind of fantastic wood decomposer to, you know, chew on the wood and make it go away. So the next question was, are there any fungi involved, or what are the fungi at Mount Baldy and on these structures? And here's a little bit of wood here. If you look close, you can start to see, oh, look, there's a little bit of hyphae on these little bits and flecks of wood sticking out of the sand dune. Here's an additional hole that the geomorphology group located and measured. And again, they're really busy measuring all the dimensions of the holes and everything. And I was there to kind of point out, yep, there's some fungus right there. There's some hyphae right there. So you can kind of see, you know, it doesn't look all that sort of great in the images here, but pretty clear structures. Here's Charlie Morris is one of the scientists at the park. And he was involved in this. And so you can kind of see him. You see how he sort of here's a log right here. Excuse me. And kind of see at some point either it itself folded, or maybe it's a branch or something like that had kind of diverted itself down into the hole. And then, of course, you can see these little fungal hyphen-like structures off the side. And again, they took it to the next level of really looking at the, you know, the mineralogy of the little, they were really interested in how did the hole stay in shape. And they thought there was a little kind of sort of carbonaceous sort of little wall to it. I, again, it was sort of beyond my means at sort of seeing that, but they were taking little samples of the side. And in those samples, what they were able to see in the electron micrographs that they took of those, lots of little fungal hypha-like structures in there. So these little thread-like, cell-like structures that you see here. Backing out a little bit, of course, we want to know, well, okay, we know there's a lot of fungi in the Indiana dunes, right? And probably, you know, reasonable estimates that some of us have put together is at least over 1,000 species of fungi Indiana Dunes National Park. And of those, probably hundreds involved in some kind of decomposition of wood from beginning to end. And this is a good diagram to spend a little bit of time on if you've not seen it before. Work by Lynn Boddy, one of the main wood decomposition experts in the world. And she basically, you know, kind of laid out the process of wood decomposition in nature, right? So you sort of had this beginning phase where you have your mass, and then over time, you know, probably somewhere in the order of up to about 100 years or so, where you get down to that point of, man, there's not much of that tree left, maybe 30% or something like that, and slowly starts to disintegrate. But at each of these different phases, you've got different events occurring in those in that wood. So you've got the sort of the fragmentation part. You've got the various sort of roles of microbes, fungi in particular, and then, you know, the different kinds of sort of wood decay sort of phases in there. And this gives us a good estimate of the timing of things. So we take this kind of estimate and we sort of fit it with those geomorphology numbers and the georeferencing of the timing of things. Then we can start to piece together the kind of the history and the map of this particular location, at least to see if it makes sense with what we know about wood decomposition in general. So we know there's fungi. Do the time, you know, does the time match up? We did some initial sampling from those little wood chips, just sort of some of the grabs of wood that were in those initial holes that were found. And we found, not surprisingly, plenty of, or at least some wood decomposers, or at least fungi that are common in habitats that are very well decomposed wood. So we found a species of Lepiota, for instance. Not this particular one, this is just a picture of a Lepiota. We found some Schizophyllum and Satharellos as well, also both. This is actually a picture of a Schizophyllum on some of the wood there, so you can see some of the little wood structures. So those two are well known. And then this was probably the coolest thing that we found mycologically up there on top of Baldy. So as I mentioned before, you see some of these little sort of outcroppings that are basically the tops of these trees that are decomposed. And besides these little herbaceous plant that's popping out here, you also see tons and tons of, well, my immediate thought was rhizomorphs. And that's ultimately what they are, of an armillaria. But, you know, at the time, it was such a kind of surprise to even sort of see these things in sort of the way that they were kind of growing all over the surface of the sand and around these little spots and whatnot. It was just sort of, you know, really kind of unsettling a little bit to sort of see this at once. And they were all over. So this is actually Scott Bates, who's at Purdue. He made a trip up there with me. And again, you can kind of see one of the little trunks here, and you can see another trunk up close, and all of this rhizomorph just surrounding this whole area left and right. And you can see it's a good sort of expanse of the spots there. This is actually Wyatt Gaswick, who many of you know. Wyatt made a trip up there with me as well. And Wyatt was impressed, with these things. They're big and thick, and they're just kind of all over the place. Just to double check at first, I wanted to make sure it was, minimally fungal. I mean, I scraped off some of the rind and macerated it up and put it under the microscope. And this is certainly good fungal hyphae in those rhizomorphs. And I think you all know a good bit about rhizomorphs, probably more than I do, but just to sort of remind ourselves that these are, you know, subterranean structures, or in this case, sort of just structures, not necessarily subterranean, but typically subterranean, or that come up the sides of trees that the rhizomorph forming fungus is colonized, and this is a mechanism for it to sort of find another tree to colonize. In effect, and presumably, you know, parasitize and to decompose. What's kind of neat, found some other sort of information in these structures, is that some of the different sort of components by some of the folks who've looked at rhizomorphs up close like to argue that there's a bit of an oxygen conducting channel in the sort of central sort of structure of this, which if we pull this back to the sort of thinking about what's happening under a sand dune, that might be a particularly valuable adaptation in these kinds of environments. And so, of course, who are these fungi? Well, Armillaria. Armillaria is the primary fungus that is going to make a rhizomorph. And, you know, maybe some can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm reasonably confident these are the only ones that make rhizomorphs in Northwest Indiana that I'm familiar with. You know, many of you know probably Armillaria mellia, a typical oak pathogen, which makes sense here as well. It's involved in white rot as well, so that also makes sense here. So I'm gonna shift gears real quick and just kind of dive into the knowledge that we kind of gained about Armillaria at this particular site. So I'm gonna stop my share real quick because I need to pull up a different set of slides. Hold on. Because a student of mine worked on this project. So coming right back here. Okay, so this is work that was conducted by an undergraduate student of mine, Ashlyn Morin. She was one of the undergrads who took my mycology course. This was at the Smith Foray up to Wisconsin a couple of years ago. What Ashlyn wanted to do was to figure out which particular Armillaria species this was, because we knew that there were several different species here. Mellia, tibescens, gallica, and you all know a good bit about some of these. So the Mellia, for instance, has got an annulus, and tibescens typically does not. And then gallica has apparently got a little bit of some kind of vulva and a bit of an annulus as well. Okay, but we didn't see these, right? We saw the rhizomorphs. And so also what's kind of neat about this that helped certainly sort of pique our interest in this was that Armillaria gallica, of course, is the famous humongous fungus from the famous Smith study from 1980. They did a 2018 update of that study, if you didn't know. It's a really neat paper, but basically sort of expanded the size of that particular humongous fungus. And this is just their particular map from their study in that. Ashlyn, learned that the rhizomorph formers, or the ones that form rhizomorphs, are Mellia and Gallica. And so which one are we dealing with here? And so Ashlyn and I made a trip out there to collect some more of the rhizomorphs. So we gather them up in these little sampling containers here. You can just sort of see there, and there's Ashlyn's foot. In these different locations, this is her map that she made while she was collecting these samples. And you can see a picture of me here. And again, you can get a good sense of what these rhizomorphs are sort of like up here. And again, around the sort of trunks. And here's another one of these little holes that we sort of found when we were up there. So they're not uncommon. It's like not impossible to find some of these up there. And you kind of just see the little rhizomorph there. So she went ahead and extracted the DNA from these. I don't know if that little works, but basically used a little liquid nitrogen, which is always a lot of fun. The ITS sequenced the ITS region and then built a little phylogeny here. And the samples that she collected, as well as some of the ones that we had from 2015, all fell into the clade of Gallica, or at least the clay that Steve Russell had identified as Gallica. There's some other Gallicas down here that are mixed up that aren't in that group, but this is a pretty well well respected Gallica. So Armillaria Gallica is that rhizomorph, to sort of settle that story. But we realize that it's not only that fungus out there. So let me come back to the other story there. And hold on a second here. Just need to get out of this. So again, we know at least for the ones that we sampled, Armillaria, not Melia, but certainly Gallica is the one that we have there on Mount Baldy. But what other fungi are there? And so this particular 2015 corresponded with when I was doing a sabbatical, and I was learning how to do what's now called eDNA, environmental DNA, and it's what mycologists have been doing for decades already, but basically pulling out all of the fungal DNA from a sample and then doing the high throughput next generation sequencing. And so I designed a study where I put to use this technology called MySeq, which is at the Field Museum, which is where I was doing my kind of sabbatical. It wasn't really a sabbatical, I didn't go far away. Built a sampling design to go back to these different locations where those holes were found, or we could find those areas where there were organic matter, and basically sample what we refer to as stovepipes, these devil stovepipe areas. Okay, so we sampled in areas that were basically sort of outside of the zone, so in sand, more than 10 meters from that organic matter, and then right at those areas, so at those sort of obviously exposed areas, but then also at the same area of number two, but just in the sand sort of next to that, okay? and we did the next generation sequencing on that, and here's a rough overview of what we found. About 345 species of fungi. Again, these are operational taxonomic units, but sort of roughly clustered into species. So about close to 350 species there. Of those, about 236 were saprotrophs, and of those, 33 wood saprotrophs. So the potential number of decomposer fungi at this particular, at least at that time point, was a couple of dozen, okay, and definitely included some of the ones that we already found. But then there were some other neat things that we found. We, plant pathogens, and probably, those along with these other pathogens are all just coming in the spore rain. If you start to think about where the wind is coming from, this is a sand dune that's kind of catching spores from basically a little bit of Lake Michigan, of course, but then the whole city of Chicago and everything upwind. Okay, so most of these, where you see things like mycorrhizal, it's not to say that there are a whole lot of mycorrhizal fungi growing on Mount Baldy, but these are primarily spores, mostly ectomycorrhizal. Those woods around Mount Baldy are full of ectomycorrhizal fungi. And some of these other interesting ones, animal pathogens, a few little lichenized ones, at least with the methods that we used. And this is a little bit of a close-up of that list. So we had 104 samples that we ran in this. And this column just states whether or not we found it there. This column in a particular sample, this is the total number of what we referred to as sequence reads. Don't think of it as a direct sort of relationship to abundance, but sort of a semi-rough proxy for that. So the higher this number is, the likely it is there's more biomass of that. but take that along with the sort of frequency of it to think about, is it all over, or is it just really dense in one particular location? And then which particular genus, and then there are different trophic modes if they're in the guild, and kind of what kind of fungus it is. So here's, kind of the top 10, a whole bunch of Alternaria, a bunch of things we don't know. And then, not surprisingly, our malaria. So this was independent of the rhizomorph samples that we got. So this was just in the organic matter and in those sand areas. And then a whole bunch of other things that nothing too sort of I guess outstanding. You know, maybe Zylaria, some folks know. Mortariella is kind of an interesting soil fungus. So we found our malaria. It was frequent, but only a few of those ones that we found, it was highly abundant. Okay. So the sort of last figure, even though it sort of refers to it being found in 70, most of those were really low abundance. It was only in three samples was it very, very highly abundant. One, of course, super common one is this alternaria, which is this just kind of sort of moldy type of thing. Makes lots and lots of spores. We found this both in the sand and in the organic matter. And, you know, presumably this is just blowing in. And so just lots and lots of alternaria blowing in that particular site. So that's what we got at that in the, what we were referring to as the stovepipes. So in those actual spots where holes were being formed, so we kind of have this sense of the fungi there at that time point. So we wondered, well, those have been buried under the ground for, you know, presumably maybe somewhere in the order of 80 years or so, at least the organic matter that they're colonizing has been buried. Whether or not they have been there that long, that's another question, but at least we have a sense of that. So what about trees that are currently being buried by sand? Are they the same kinds of fungi or are they different? So could we look at some, what we like to refer to as modern analogs, and basically go to the slip side of the dune. Again, this is that side that's sort of slowly encroaching inland, and see if some of the trees that are just now being buried, how similar, how different are those, are the fungi on those particular trees in comparison to what we found on the stovepipes, those devil stovepipes. So you can see as you cut that slip face, a whole bunch of trees being buried, right? And all of these, as they get buried, they're well, they're full of fungus, as you all know. So here's, you know, these nice little brackets and some phyllinus here that made for some nice pretty pictures. I enlisted Gail Tonkovich, who has worn many multiple hats and a long, great career at the Field Museum at Indiana University with me, and also some work with the National Park as well. And here's Scott Bates, who joined me on this escapade as well. And so our objective here was to basically sample the trees that were being buried. So we took a little method from Dan Lindner up in Wisconsin, who's done this kind of thing, basically drill in the tree, get the wood shavings, and then pull the DNA out of that and see what you find. So in these modern analogs, we had fewer trees that we sampled. So we found, generally speaking, sampled a much smaller island, if you will, only about 225 species. And the fungi were generally not the same. So in the modern analogs, with the exception of the R. malaria, we'll come back to that in just a second. Things that we didn't find in the stovepipes. Okay, so the trees that were being buried right now, or sort of at that point in time, were harboring largely different fungal communities than the ones that were sort of in those stovepipes, with the exception of the R. malaria. Okay. And again, we only looked at 12 trees, okay, so the sample size is quite a bit different, so that could have some influence here. But basically, with the exception of our malaria, none of these are all the modern ones, so things like Phlebia and Sterium, we didn't see any others. So if we compare those two lists, so the stovepipes to the modern analogs, the only one that matched up was our malaria, which is kind of interesting. So that some suggestion that maybe there's persistence in that R. malaria, or at least some ability of that R. malaria to kind of connect into these trees there. So if we go back to that limb body diagram and look at the sort of decay over time, we can kind of rough approximate pinpoint where we are in this study, right? So the stovepipes were in about 80 years or so. So probably somewhere between phase three and phase four, really mostly heavily rotted trees. And then this modern analog up here is really kind of just early phase decomposition. And one of the other things that I think kind of comes out of Lynn Body's work and that many, you know, sort of folks point out is that it's not one fungus involved in this decomposition. It's the whole communities of fungi that change over time. And that's very consistent with what we found. We found one community here and a different community here, with the exception of our malaria. Okay, so the sort of the final question in this is that we sort of wonder, well, under the dune is a really bizarre environment. Is there any way we can kind of, experiment or build a simulation of this and see what can happen? And you know, I had all kinds of crazy ideas and then haphazardly stumbled on a way to sort of simulate this because we had gotten some wood chunks from Mount Baldy, so from one of those holes that formed, and had done a little work on them and put them in very large containers, covered them, and put them into a refrigerator and forgot about them, completely forgot about them. About a year later, like, oh, you know, we have those samples sitting in the fridge. I wonder if what they're doing. And I wonder if couldn't a refrigerator be a version of what it's like underneath a sand dune? And a sand dune, if you think about it, is cold and damp and dark. And that's largely what a refrigerator is. And so here was one, albeit crude, experimental approach to simulate what it's like to be under the sand dune or Mount Baldy. The other reason that it made me think of this is when we put these wood pieces into these containers, we had these little spots that we found fungus, but they were not moldy. When we uncovered them, they were moldy. They were definitely full of hyphal fragments, not moldy like penicillin moldy, but I mean moldy by filamentous fungus. And so lo and behold, went ahead and took some of that tissue from those simulated experiments. Okay. So I had a batch that actually had grabbed in 2014 and had thrown it in the freezer, and another batch in 2016. And so we actually had 2 years of the simulated, or 2 year dune simulation experiment. So I can kind of get the when it started and then 2 years later. And so again, this is a crude sort of approach, but what's neat is that there was relatively little overlap in those two time points, right? Scytolidium, which I know nothing about, and Nectariaceae, which is also a group that I know very little about, were the only consistent taxa from 2014 to 2016 in our crude experiment. Again, suggesting that there's a whole group of fungi involved in this. Their dynamics are interesting. They're changing through time. And you know, there's a lot going on. If you wonder about our malaria, found a little tiny bit. Remember this number two here, just like percentage of the total sequences, a tiny little bit of that in 2014, again, in the dune simulated one, but it did not continue to grow in this particular environment. We found basically 0% of it in 2016. So if we go back to our little figure here and lay on this experimental time point, right, this is a little bit further along. Again, it's probably a whole sort of continuation of a group of fungi slowly getting in through this organic matter that ultimately is what used to make up a tree that was buried by a dude. Now, lots of additional questions, right? Tons and tons of neat questions that could be looked at. Like, what really is the oxygen like under there? There's decomposition occurring below the dune surface. that's a process, that's an aerobic process, requires oxygen. Is there enough down there to do it? Well, at least for our malaria, if they've got rhizomorphs way down there, they've got these structures that apparently can get that there. How to measure that, you know, variable is not quite sure. You know, what's the moisture like? Well, we do know that ground penetrating radar picks up moisture. And so that moisture is probably largely in a dune sort of environment. And this is what the dune geomorphologist explained to me. It's usually what happens is when it rains on these dunes, it doesn't just kind of drain right through the dune. It gets sucked into these things like, you know, these types of wooden structures and whatnot. It kind of goes there. So you've got oxygen, you've got plenty of moisture. And then what's the temperature like? It's not clear. I don't think anyone's actually put temperature probes under a sand dune throughout the year to see what those conditions are like. Presumably, probably, you know, less dynamic than at the surface of the dune, so perhaps deeper down. So it could be that you've got conditions that are fully conducive to wood decomposition under these sand dunes. Okay. Now, kind of a final little question here that I don't have here is, you know, you could also have trees that were that were decomposed before the dunes came on them and just stayed in place until the dune kind of made its way over the top of that. That's completely likely, and we're not arguing that isn't the case by any means. Okay, so that's pretty much my story about fungi and devil stovepipes. Just a quick shout out to folks who helped me. the trip that I made up there with Wyatt, our sort of guide from the Park Service, was a guy named Jack Hammer, which I found really hilarious. Great, great guy. Apparently, he's got a radio show somewhere in Northwest Indiana. Josh Dickey was our other guide up there. Charlie Morrison, Park Service, Scott Bates, Gail Tonkovich, and Aaron Argelon. So thanks to all those guys. And with that, I'm all done, and we'll take all these questions that looks like folks are having. And I'll stop sharing for now and open the floor up to whatever you got.
One person, it was actually sent directly to me. But what did Mr. Avis say was an aerobic process under the dune?
Decomposition. Basically, you know, the at least fungi utilizing organic matter as a food, you know, largely a carbon source, right? Generally speaking, is an aerobic process. Or at least that's my understanding. If I'm ignorant on that, then I'm all ears. But I think of decomposition in general as aerobic.
Okay. This was already kind of answered by Patrick, but nonetheless, were the rhizomorphs of our malaria bioluminescent?
Never went out there at night. And I would encourage any of you who want to check that out to let me know if they are.
Okay. So that was somebody was asking if the devil's stovepipes glowed with foxfire, but that again is the same direction. So Finn, check it out and let us know.
Yeah, I think that spot is open. I don't know if technically they want you up there at night, but it would be a cool spot to go hang out at nighttime. It might be a little light, but hey, there's Dan Linder's iPhone to everyone. Cytolidium.
Yeah, Dan, do you want to add something?
Yeah.
If I can figure out how to take myself off of
mute. We can hear you.
Okay. yes, I couldn't help myself because when you said you didn't know anything about those Scatlidium species, those, it turns out, are really super cool in that they come in and they're well known for inhibiting a range of decay species.
Oh, wow.
And so it might be... they're really good at taking over territory. They're not really good at decomposition, but they're really good at inhibition.
So maybe that, because they popped up in that our crude, you know, simulation, right? So maybe they're good in a refrigerator.
And it makes me wonder if it's an effect, a refrigerator effect. But the general story with our malaria and everything from beginning to end definitely completely tracks, but just wanted to, I was trying to look up that citation on the scalidium, because that's something that when we drill into wood, we tend to see, and it often comes up like possibly under Fun Guild, still is like unknown, but there is some interesting, it's one of those few kind of strange groups that actually people have studied the interactions of and how they interact with other decay fungi. So just a tiny side note.
Awesome. That's great to know. Like I said, so many of these fungi. That's why I was talking to you long ago about this, Dan.
Well, and it was really interesting to see your list of things that you came up with in the contemporary ones, where the Phlebias and the two Sterium species and how those drop out, and that it's the armillaria that's really consistent across those two times. And that's really interesting.
Yeah. Do you think the armillaria is, I mean, what does it do?
Oh, yeah. Armillaria is so well known at hunkering down. It can produce those pseudosclerotial plates. And there are multiple studies going back to the 30s showing that it can hang out for at least 40 years in those in a stump that was cut. And so I think it hunkers down, and it's the combination of its ability to defend territory as well as those rhizomorphs like you were showing. So what else could, it's kind of like dry rot or serpula or something where it can connect a water source 30 meters away to a food source. And it's probably just the only thing out there that, as the Phlebias and the Steriums and everything else get sort of snuffed out over time, that can have a wide enough network to still be able to gather moisture and do everything it needs to do to be able to actually decompose those things. And I think it's also really interesting that it's Gallica that you tend to find, because that also just seems to completely track with a really good saprophyte compared to Melia that seems to be more associated with living trees.
Huh.
And doesn't, once the tree dies, doesn't stay around as long, where Melia is the one that, at least in our area, being Southern Wisconsin and not that different from, Indiana, Gallica is the absolute dominant armillaria species.
Wow. Cool. That's great to hear, Dan. I appreciate that. Wow. Huh.
Yep.
I have a question. Probably it's really for you, Dan, in a sense. But at what point does the tree give up and die? Under these suggestions? It's not getting much oxygen after a while.
I love those pictures that that Pete was showing in terms of how they're getting engulfed like that. And I actually had the exact same question, because at what point does the tree die? Obviously, it's amazing what trees can, so long as they can still photosynthesize. I would love to know if they're still sort of green at the top for a while. But my guess is,
I think most of the trees are. They're, at a certain point they're done, because they're really stressed. That's
that's where armillaria proliferates. And that's the other thing that would be kind of the Lynn body work of that armillaria, especially Gallica, has probably pre-colonized those trees starting from the roots, and that it thrives on that stress response. Oh. And tends to explode. And there's work going back to Glenn Stanos also, in terms of not with oak, but with aspen populous species, of drought, how armillaria responds to drought and other things, and how it just takes off. But that would have been a different species of armillaria. That would have been a northern, wouldn't have been Gallica, but close enough.
Yeah. So we toyed with another title for this, which was the "Did a Humongous Fungus Swallow a Little Boy?" And that's one of those questions. Everybody wants to know: do they have the humongous fungus, right? And so, do we say that because it's the same species, or do we say that until we hold that reserve until we go do all the genetic tests and whatnot, which is, you know, would have been a great thing to continue to do. Or if anyone's interested, that thing is, you know, it's up there. So.
Greg or Patrick, do you, or anybody want to add something to that?
You know, this is about wood rot. We got Dan Linder on the phone. I can't add anything to that, man. Really cool stuff. But I found fascinating. So you didn't find any of those environmental samples. I mean, like the alternaries and everything on your modern analogs, right? So that really looked like it was post-deposition that you were picking
up. Yeah. And actually, so when you look at, so we remember we took some samples that were in the sand. So up, like uphill from the, so it was just pure sand. And that's what it was packed with, that alternaria and some of the other ones. So, you know, lots of spore rain. So a lot of, you know, a lot of neat questions about who's making spores and what. So, but we didn't, yeah, I think part of it also is that that slip side didn't have this, you know, the wind dynamics are different there. So it's just like a little bit of sand coming down. And we also, we were drilling into the tree there. Whereas on the stovepipes, that was all like right on the surface, either on that wood that's being decomposed or actually in the sand itself. So it's a pretty kind of different location.
Yeah. So, you know, those spore deposits is fascinating because, you know, I get a lot of questions about eDNA or environmental DNA for extending geographic distributions of species. And, you know, this is a great example that, you know, just because you find some DNA, you find a signal, doesn't necessarily mean that the thing has been established and persists, right, and is actually functioning in the ecosystem.
Right.
A great example.
Yep.
And Andy has his hand up, so we should definitely go to him. But I would say RNA, that's one of those that what Greg is saying, I think, is a perfect that trying to get beyond like what Ari Jumponen and others had shown in terms of spore rain near like glacial fronts, trying to use you know, RNA and like not just can you detect these things with DNA, but are they alive, I think is really sort of the next frontier in terms of figuring out some of that stuff. But I jumped in front of Andy.
And Andy, you could
have. Thanks, Dan. yeah, so Matt Nelson shared with us an article you were talking about, the origin of collapse features appearing in the migrating parabolic dunes along the southern coast of Lake Michigan. And one of the highlights they point out, hadn't had a chance to fully read the paper, but they talk about the wood decay fungi biomineralize a cement at contact between organic mineral and sand. Did it feel like it was like a concrete tube or something?
To the dune geomorphology folks, they were nuts about it. And they were like, it's like the, I'm trying to think of a kind of an example. It's like a thin little crust. You know, the kind of like thin little chocolate crust you get on an ice cream cone sometimes with that little, like the chocolate on top, like thinner than that, kind of granular. And to me, I wouldn't even, you know, just, I wouldn't have noticed anything like that. But they were all excited about it and said that they needed to have that in order for them to say that's how you could maintain that structure. I'm like, okay, sure. And I didn't, you know, there were some, I think, references in terms of like, you know, exudates that could combine with the minerals. And then you could, if you had all this decomposition occurring, then you could have that form. Okay. They were excited about that. So
are these stovepipes, is that confined just to Mount Baldy, or is that something that should be looked for elsewhere?
Look for it elsewhere. Other sand dunes that have migrated onto other dunes. And I think that's what the Ken Kesey thing was about, is that in the dunes of Oregon, apparently that's what they were seeing. Erin Argelon, so my colleague at IU Northwest, she's since kind of been sort of building up a sort of a database of where these other locations are. And some of the Western Michigan dunes have some of these features. A couple of the European areas, I think in the Baltic Sea, maybe one other area, maybe in the Caribbean somewhere, I forget exactly, but there were a couple other areas that she started to learn about, at least this kind of thing. I don't know, there was a question about if this is an accepted geomorphological term. I'm not sure if it is. I forget the decision to use that term was, again, beyond me, and I just started to adopt it. So is the risk should, you know, yeah, I guess I think just be aware, I guess. No, it's not like I was afraid to fall in these holes by any means. I was not, I was like up there, no problem. And you could see them. And I think it's small creatures like children to be aware of on dunes, sand dunes.
Are those dunes likely to be closed permanently, Mount Baldy?
No, it's open again. It's so you can go out there. They ask you not to go scrambling up the dune, though. And that's true elsewhere so that you don't, you know, tear up the vegetation and whatnot. But
are there any other big active dunes, though, like Mount Baldy that would be doing this?
Not to the scale at Mount Baldy. I think Crescent Dune is still active, and there's maybe one or two other ones, but they're all smaller. And again, part of this is because of it's sort of semi-natural, right? That sand dune is sort of not naturally that big. It's getting more sand than it's sort of naturally would have gotten because of the Michigan City Pier that has kind of blocked up the sand conveyor belt offshore. And so it stacks up out there and that blows it in. So kind of odd situation.
Well, Matt Nelson's had to run, but he said this was great. And he remembered when it happened, and it's really cool to see how the role fungi played in this.
Yeah, well, glad to hear it. I say, I think pretty much all of you would have thought the same thing. You're like, whoa, fungus is out there doing it.
By the way, how deep are these holes or the caves usually?
So, sorry. Again, the one that I showed you here, I put my arm down. I was up to my shoulder, and I could not touch the bottom. I didn't feel it. So there was at least, you know, that one was at least 3-4 feet deep. They estimate that that little boy who fell in was 15 to 20 feet deep. So substantial. And different angles too. So, you know, not all straight up and down, but some kind of on an angle and kind of like tree branches, which is what they used to be.
Did he fall straight down or was it on an angle?
They think it was mostly straight down.
Okay, so it used to be common practice, even encouraged, to summit Mount Baldy. And my understanding is that no longer allowed. The trail has been rerouted around it, so the area is open, but you're no longer supposed to be climbing it any longer.
Yep, I think that's the hope, that people won't go climbing up there. But they debated on, you know, do they close it off? But, you know, the national parks in general have all kinds of dangerous features like buffalo and, you know, things that they don't keep people away from. So not that buffalo or bison are dangerous, but, you know, you hear about people getting stampeded and whatnot, and they don't prevent people from getting, you know, run over or eaten by grizzly bears and things. So that same idea was in place here, is that eventually, once they had enough understanding of it, that just open it back up, but be cautious.
Pete, any idea on the tree composition of what trees were buried 70 years ago?
Yeah, they're pretty sure those were some of the black oaks.
Okay.
Based on that old aerial imagery, that and probably everything that's been there, maybe cottonwood, but likely the oaks. And I think the composition of those stumps and whatnot, you sort of see them, they kind of have that oaky kind of sense to them. Again, everything that's getting buried is pretty much that. So
does that fit with Lynn's body's decomposition timeline? Was that for like an oak? I mean, I assume, depending on how, that a much softer tree, wood tree, yeah, would decompose at a faster rate, it might go through the same steps, but at a different time course. But
that's a good question. I don't know exactly if oaks fit that. I generally thought it was kind of a reasonable approximation for hardwoods, but could be something to consider there.
Yeah, I know for when we're doing our environment, our assessments of extinction risk and on wood decay fungi, we factor how long the substratum might persist based on, oaks being long, these other things much shorter lived and decompose much faster. So kind of, and that was all based on, Scandinavian data, because they got all the data, right? They've measured decay rate on all these trees up there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, if there's no more questions.
All right. Well,
thank you for your time.
My pleasure. It was good to see many of you, and I hope you're all doing well. I'll reach out to several of you to chat more soon. Okay.
Thanks, Pat.
Very good. All right,
everyone, take care.
Thank you.
Enjoy the spring wherever you are.
Thank you for the update.
Hope the snow melts.
Thanks.